From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvard economist Roland G. Fryer didn't start life on a sure footing. His family knew trouble and hard times. But at the tender age of 27, Fryer is hitting a pretty fast stride. He's asking tough questions about why Black America isn't doing better and what now can be done to close the achievement gap. Tonight on Point, a young Black economist's quest for answers to tough questions about Black performance in America. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where the Supreme Court today handed down a key ruling on age discrimination in the workplace. The 5-3 decision found that workers can recover damages from their employers, for harm caused by age discrimination, even if the harm was not deliberate. It also effectively moved the threshold for such cases down to cover any worker more than 40 years old. Fred Barbash is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He covered today's ruling. Fred, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So what's the deep impact being interpreted as here in this ruling, Fred?
The deep impact is that older workers, meaning workers over 40, like myself, who sue for age discrimination, will not have to prove that the discrimination was intentional, that is, that an employer set out to discriminate on the basis of age. This is something that already exists in civil rights law with regard to gender discrimination and racial discrimination, but had not been applied to the Age Discrimination in Employment Act of 1967, and now it has been. But there's an important exception here. If the employer, the Supreme Court says that if the employer can show that the effect of the action, even though not intentional, had another reason, that is a reasonable factor, for example, suppose you wind up discriminating against older workers, but your reason was that you were trying to recruit people in the labor market in the area, which was the case here, then that can be okay. That defense is not available in race discrimination cases.
So age discrimination, the application of this act has been toughened up. It's been brought closer to the standard of race. On the other hand, it's not quite as tight as race discrimination if there are other reasonable factors other than age, like, as you say, competitive pressures in the marketplace or hiring issues. There can still be some, I guess, discrimination here. Fred, can you illustrate for us a kind of discrimination that would be discernible but not deliberate? What sort of thing would that refer to?
Well, in age discrimination, it's very common. As it happens in this, let's talk about this case, which involved a bunch of older policemen in Jackson, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Younger police officers got a larger raise proportionately than the older workers did.
And that wasn't deliberate?
Older workers sued.
Mm-hmm.
The Jackson, Mississippi said, yes, this is what happened, but we had to do that in order to recruit in the job market for younger police officers, so that their purpose for doing this was not to discriminate against the older workers, it was to compete in the job market. And the Supreme Court today held specifically that that was an acceptable reason for doing what Jackson, Mississippi did. That's the kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of issue that always comes up in these age discrimination cases.
And I understand that the kind of borderland here, the borderline, has now effectively been moved to age 40. How has that happened? Because that was the age of officers involved in this case, or did the Supreme Court?
No, that was already happening. There hasn't really been a significant change in that. That's been migrating for some time.
And 40, that may not sound so terribly aged to a lot of Americans these days. Increasingly, it doesn't sound
40,
aged to me, Fred.
I don't know how it doesn't sound aged, but I don't know. If you've ever been involved in hiring, you'll find that things get a little more difficult for people over 40, and that can be and often is a reason for at least a claim of age discrimination.
Fred, lots of expectation of this kind of case being increasingly important as the baby boom ages, issues of people working longer to pay for their older years, maybe not retiring. A clarifying effect from the court's ruling today?
I would say it's mixed, because on the one hand, they don't have to prove intentional discrimination, which will encourage people to sue. On the other hand, they have to meet this very restrictive threshold in which the employer is allowed to show that he or she had other reasons. So what it will mean is that a lot of litigation will come in the doors of the courts, but the courts themselves will still have a lot of messy work to do to determine the applicable law. So I think it's in some respects kind of a messy decision, frankly.
So it sounds like more to come on this front, and with the demographics, that seems almost certain. Fred, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Fred Barbash is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us from Washington. The 27-year-old Harvard economist Roland Fryer grew up poor and black in a family that was falling apart. His mother abandoned him, his father drank too much, beat him. Fryer sold drugs, carried a gun, he was angry. And then one day, after police pulled him over and questioned him for hours, and his friends got caught in a burglary he had begged out of, Roland Fryer decided, at age 15, he wanted something different. He finished an economics degree in 2.5 years at the University of Texas. As a grad student at Penn State University, he began studying economics to study issues of race. And top economists took notice. Now he's at Harvard, asking tough questions that many white economists may be afraid to ask about why so many black Americans are not succeeding in America. He's ready to consider genetics, black culture, or anything else that might help him explain the achievement gap. Tonight on Point, a young black scholar's tough questions about why black America isn't doing better. You can join the conversation tonight. After all these years, can it be that we're still not asking and answering the right questions about race? What's your explanation for the African-American lag? What's needed here? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Roland Fryer. He's assistant professor of economics at Harvard and a junior fellow in Harvard's Society of Fellows, one of academia's most prestigious research posts. He was the subject of the March 20th Sunday New York Times Magazine profile headlined "Toward a Unified Theory of Black America." Dr. Roland Fryer, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's terrific to have you. So here you are. You're young in a great big world of economics and issues in this country, and you are charging around in lots of directions in ways that people are really paying attention to, maybe a little more attention than you expected in this recent article. You're getting what you call full media exposure here, and sometimes that's uncomfortable. I can well understand that. What's motivating you, Roland Fryer? What, as an economist, we're going to look at your research tonight and the topics you pick up and how you go at them, but what's your underlying motivation?
The motivation is pretty simple, actually. I grew up in an environment where I saw people with incredible, incredible talent, athletic ability, beautiful people who just didn't have outcomes that you'd expect given their talent level. And so the real question for me, it's almost selfishness. It's where did my friends go wrong? You know, was it their behavior? Was it societal pressure? Was it institutional discrimination? What was it that created a situation in which friends who I thought had more talent than I ever had just don't have economic outcomes that you'd expect given their talent level?
So a simple question from a youth that raised it in a very pointed way for you. And when you come into this sphere where it's all about asking questions and looking for answers and applying research practices to pin them down, I guess even wider, when you look at the American conversation around race, does it look fully candid, frank, open, as inquiring as it ought to be? Or does it feel, has it felt, too narrow?
Oh, no way. Certainly not as wide as it should be. It's political. A lot of the discussion is non-scientific. It's anecdotal. And we've really got to get to the science of this. That's what's going to get us past the next frontier. Not anecdotes, not turning an affirmative action debate based on one guy who lost his job because, a black person got in ahead of them. Not saying discrimination is rampant because someone didn't wait on them at the store as quickly as they had hoped. This is science. Race, as I like to say, is not rocket science. It's harder than that. Mm-hmm. We've really got to treat it that way. We've got to get past the political and the anecdotal and get down to the scientific.
And your scientific path, economic path, is the big road you're coming in on. The Times maybe was having a little tongue-in-cheek fun with you when they headlined the story "Toward a Unified Theory of Black America." I mean, but is that
anything like what you're looking for? When you say science, do you think there's some like big Rosetta Stone that's going to explain this whole thing? Is it just a matter of chipping away at it piece by piece?
It's just chipping away at it. I mean, the Times certainly didn't run that title by me before they published
it. And none of it, I don't imagine. But
so look, it's about putting everything on the table. Behavioral genetics, behaviors, discrimination, racism, everything on the table and cracking them open one by one. That's what this is all about. This is, you know, frankly, I never expected, you know, any type of public recognition for what I always viewed as a selfish goal. I'm just trying to understand for myself. Look, there's people out there I've seen with amazing talent. They're not doing so well. There's a lot of explanations on the table. Let's just knock them off one by one.
And are you able to ask that question because you're a black scholar with more candor than your white colleagues? Some, I'm reading here quoting, saying, they're saying, yes, it's absolutely, there's an insulation effect that is in working with you. There's no question that working with Roland is somewhat liberating.
You know, it's tough for me to actually answer, but my suspicion is that, sure, I don't think I would have put it the way the Times did, but I'm sure that there is a certain level of candor that I can reach. And I'm not so sure it's because I'm black. It may be because, you know, I kind of have street cred, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So when, you know, other, you know, Cosby-esque, and there's nothing wrong with that, blacks try to answer the same question, someone might say, well, you're not from there, so how would you know? So I think it's the combination of race and kind of background that helped me be a little bit more candid than one may. Than some may be.
Roland Fryer, we're going to get right into your research. We're glad you're with us tonight. We're talking tonight with a young black scholar who's asking some very tough, very blunt questions about why black America isn't doing better. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your question on race and achievement for Dr. Roland Fryer? What's your explanation for the African-American lag? Have you chalked it up to discrimination and stopped asking anything more? Have you chalked it up to bad behavior and left it at that? How do you see it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unresolved black achievement gap in America and why it's still there. My guest tonight, Roland Fryer, is assistant professor of economics at Harvard University. He's young, he's black, he's asking blunt questions, and he's turning heads with those questions. You can join us tonight as well. What's your question on race and achievement tonight? Are there questions you feel you can't ask? Questions a white scholar wouldn't ask? Questions that only a young black economist, maybe like Roland Fryer, can raise? And are there questions that should be off the table? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, I want to get to your research because you've got some pretty head-turning subjects here. Let's just walk through some of this so we can begin to get a sense of the kind of questions you're raising, the kind of answers you're finding. You know, one very simple one, we mentioned at the top of the show, but it's about identifiably kind of black names.
Mm-hmm.
And they're economic implications, I guess.
Right.
A, why did you choose to look at it? And B, what did you find?
Yeah, I chose to look at it because there's this kind of unresolved question, which is black culture causing or is it the consequence of black underachievement? Right? That is...
Sure we go. Is it causing or is it the consequence? All right. All right.
Okay. So the idea here is that, you know, is it that people give their kids black names because they're segregated and kind of apart from the mainstream, or is it they're giving their kids black names and that's causing them to be segregated and out of the mainstream?
That is, that maybe they're not hired because
that's exactly right.
The name shows up on a resume or a list of applicants. And I mean, here I'm looking at these numbers. California, 1989 to 2000, 457 boys named Tyrone,
that's right.
445 black,
right.
270 same girls named Shanice. 274, all but three, black. So, I mean,
exactly.
This is no mystery. Everybody's seen this.
Absolutely.
And it's an economist. It seems a reasonable question to say, is that keeping people from being hired?
Absolutely.
What did you find?
We found that the answer is just no. Look, when you just look at names like Shanice or Shaniqua, Lakeisha, et cetera,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
those names are associated with poorer outcomes. Okay, so life expectancy is lower. They're more likely to live in a low-income zip code. However, it's really the circumstances at birth that matter. So if you take a woman named Sally and one named Shanice, and they're both born in the same hospital and have mothers of the same education level, we found that 20-some-odd years later, they're going to have the same outcomes. Right? So it's not really your name that's causing you to have bad outcomes. It's that they're already segregated and they're giving their kids these names. This is an important question because if black culture were perpetuating black inequality, mm-hmm. then we'd have a real issue on our hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the key to this paper is that it's very hard. How the heck do you measure culture, Tom? I mean, it's, mm-hmm. How do you measure culture? It's a very squishy kind of mm-hmm. thing. Well, one way to think about trying to have quantitative measures of culture, because again, we want to make this scientific, is to think about names as a kind of cultural investment.
But let me ask you in there, it seems to convey a kind of absolution for, let's say, white human resource, guys and gals who do the hiring. Your conclusion seems to suggest that when they see Sally and they see Shaniqua, they're not discriminating on the basis of race. Are you prepared to say that? Because if Sally and Shaniqua have the same background, they have an equal chance of being hired.
I'm prepared to say, I don't want to say anything I'm not very confident mm-hmm. about. I'm prepared to say, I'm not sure whether or not they're discriminating based on Shanice or whether they're discriminating based on the fact that Shanice had a bad background. And in order to do that, what we've got to do is we've got to send out resumes not of Shanice and Molly, right, who differ not only in race but in terms of kind of background.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to send out Shanice with the kid from Lower Illinois named Little Bubba Leroy. We have mm-hmm. to compare those two mm-hmm. people
right.
to be able to get a real true test of whether or not it's race versus class.
Sort of comparable places in the class education structure.
Right. Exactly.
But you can see why this would make people nervous, though, because people who fear that discrimination is actually always grinding away under the covers here
yes.
are going to say, well, but you're opening up a kind of a free pass here for folks who may be discriminating, but they're going to say, it's just about education level and background.
No. I'm just saying, I thought the question posed to me was mm-hmm. whether or not it's racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say one type of discrimination is better than another.
Mm-hmm.
I said this is not necessarily racial discrimination, which is, that's the only, I'm making a small point here.
And interestingly, in your conclusion I'm looking at here, you conclude that carrying a black name is primarily a consequence rather than a cause of poverty and segregation, meaning what people without means, black Americans without means, are turning to these names. You're saying it's a consequence of poverty and segregation. They're turning to these names, to express, to have something when they don't have economic means. They have cultural pride or a sense of it instead?
It's a terrific question. One in which we just really don't have good scientific answers. I mean, I have no clue why mm-hmm. My parents named me Roland and yours named you Tom.
Mm-hmm.
But it is conceivable that in a arena where there is rampant segregation and there probably is substantial discrimination, that people wouldn't turn to naming their kids as really an identity choice, something mm-hmm. they can be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't surprise me if that were true, but I have no good evidence that whether or not that's true.
It's very interesting where economics can take a scholar and where it can't,
exactly.
As you try and keep it within this kind of narrow frame we call science.
Exactly.
Let's pick up another one. Acting white.
Yes.
This, of course, is a phenomenon everybody's heard about. Black kids studying hard in tough environments, ostracized because
yes.
they're seen as acting white in their studious behavior.
Right.
So how did you frame your question looking at this again? What did you find?
Well, I did it in two parts. One was purely theoretical and the other was empirical. The theoretical paper just tried to understand what type of situations would lead to these accusations of acting white. Okay, because, some people who observe the acting white phenomenon would naively say, look, there's just something defective about black people. I mean, they just keep accusing each other of, why wouldn't they want their successful
members?
Somebody
tries to get ahead,
exactly.
others drag that person down.
Precisely, mm-hmm. precisely. And so my first reaction to that was, no, that's not the way to think about it. The way to think about it is that you have people interacting in a social environment, and there's some environments in which you might understand why there may be animosity directed towards education. And there's nothing unique about blacks here. I want to make this point very clear.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing unique about blacks in my paper concerning acting white. This is also true of the Italian immigrants in Boston's West End in 1960, the Maori of New Zealand, the Sephardic Jews of Israel. There are groups across the world who kind of have this phenomenon where high achievers are kind of scorned.
Are you betraying the old
exactly.
country culture?
Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out whether or not you're with us or you're against us. So mm-hmm. you could take a kid from Lower Illinois, and if he starts really doing well in school, the question might be, do you think you're too good to get off the farm?
Right. What's that accent? What's that posture?
Exactly.
Get your nose out of the air.
Right. Are you going to identify with us or you're not? I think that's the central question. Mm-hmm. And that's the question, theoretically, I'm trying to understand in this paper.
So you come down in your conclusion saying acting white is what you call an equilibrium phenomenon, the consequence of two audience signaling.
Yes.
That is?
That's just fancy language for saying you want to impress employers, but you want to show your friends that you're going to be part of their group as well. So you have attention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see? So if you're on the farm in Illinois, you're saying, look, I'd like to get a good job, but, you know, if I start studying a lot, people are going to start wondering.
My folks are going to, well, of course, it all depends. I mean, you're in a cloaked way talking about my own upbringing. And I have to say, I mean, there was a very high value put, even in a circumstance of limited means, on education. But still, yes, there's putting on airs was something
Absolutely.
That people were very sensitive to.
It's got to be clear here. This is not about values. Mm-hmm. This paper doesn't argue that blacks don't value education. That would mm-hmm. be ludicrous. There mm-hmm. are, you know, just a lot of information throughout history where, no, that's exactly false. This paper's arguing putting on airs. It's about who you identify with. Are you acting white? Or are you going to be with us, et cetera, et cetera? So that's the type of thing we're trying to understand.
And then you end up in places where we don't expect you. A paper here with a couple of colleagues from Harvard, David Cutler and Edward Glaser.
Yes.
On slave trade. And it ties back, it gets into a kind of genetic selection, I guess, at some level, and it ties back to an image that somebody found,
yes.
if I recall this correctly, of maybe a slave market in Africa,
yes.
where one man is licking another man's face.
Yes.
Have I got that right?
That's right.
And from that, what?
Well, it's a period of illustration from 1736 on the west coast of Africa where a slave trader is licking the cheek of a potential slave, and he's trying to assess his fitness across the Middle Passage.
For the transatlantic journey.
Absolutely.
And why would licking his face be relevant to his passage?
It's a good question. Back then, they thought that saltier skin was just overall a signal of bad health. Okay. I saw this picture and thought, salt sensitivity. Because, look, this paper is really about two things, and I think the Times actually confused it, so I want to make it clear here.
Great.
There is an underlying distribution of salt sensitivity among human beings.
And by the way, we're clarifying the New York Times all the time.
Okay. Well, okay. So, Tom, you're a healthy guy. Suppose I give you 5 bags of potato chips to eat, and you've got healthy kidneys. You will urinate out the electrolytes mm-hmm. with no increase in blood pressure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And regret it, you know, for the next week.
Well, that may be true. But if you're salt sensitive, your body holds on to the salt. Mm-hmm. Which means it retains more water, your extracellular volume increases, and your blood pressure goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's how you test someone mm-hmm. for salt sensitivity. Mm-hmm. You give them lots of salt and you watch their blood pressure. So the first fact in this paper is all about understanding racial differences in salt sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's just a fact. In the current population, 50% of blacks are salt sensitive.
And this leads to hypertension, high blood pressure, and
cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. kidney disease, stroke. Okay, all of the things in which there's a 6-year difference in life expectancy between blacks and whites, the major killers, over 60% of that 6-year difference is attributable to cardiovascular-related diseases.
Okay, now here's the interesting thing. With a young economist who's being described as looking for the unified theory of black America, and early on in your career, not afraid to look at issues that are genetic.
Yes.
So this has people's antenna up because that's kind of, forbidden. I mean, your esteemed president or not, however you like it, at Harvard, Larry Summers,
yes.
raised the issue of women and their innate scientific ability, and it's just been hellfire and brimstone ever since.
Right.
Are you, in fact, interested, prepared, ready to look at genetic explanations for the kinds of questions you're raising about performance, not health as in this issue, but about achievement?
Absolutely. Let me say why, because the Times cut my quote off in half here.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm unafraid. Let's put genetics on the table. And the reason is I am unafraid. I am absolutely unafraid of the outcome. To say that I'm not willing to put genetics on the table, that's when people start whispering.
And when you say you're not afraid, what are you saying? What are you suggesting? That you're so confident
I'm so confident that there's no racial differences in the genetic makeup of human beings
mm-hmm.
that would even if, you know, first of all, I'm confident there is none, but even if there were small differences, they couldn't begin to explain the vast differences in social statistics that we observe today. So mm-hmm. I'm unafraid. Let's put it on the table. Let's put absolutely everything on the table, and let's knock them off one by one.
We're talking tonight with Roland Fryer. He is assistant professor of economics at Harvard University and turning heads with his candid questions, blunt answers in economics, the gray science. We're joined tonight from Chicago right now by James Heckman. He's a 2000 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, written extensively on race. He invited Roland Fryer to the University of Chicago in 2000 and served as Roland's mentor there for 3 years. James Heckman, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
It's good to be here.
Your former student and colleague there has gotten a pretty bright light shone on him lately. People are really interested in the kinds of questions that he's asking and in the fact of his youth and of his race asking those questions. Do you see a young black scholar in America today as having an extra margin of free rein to ask awkward questions? Is there a dynamic where white economists are leaning away from certain ways of framing issues and certain questions, Dr. Heckman?
Well, first of all, let me make a remark that Roland's agenda is Roland's agenda. I met Roland at a conference, and the very questions that he was just talking about, and I'm sure the other questions he's working on, were very much in his mind. We had plenty of discussions, and he also benefited, I think, from the entire University of Chicago environment.
No doubt.
But I would say you've raised a very good point. You mentioned a minute ago Larry Summers and the issue that was raised by the possibility, just the possibility, that there might be some differences in the way that women were able to solve mathematical problems. The issue of race is enormously more sensitive, and I think there's no question that it's a very difficult in the contemporary academic world and the contemporary policy world to have honest discussions about race, because it's very easy not only for popular figures, politicians, and men and women in the street, but also for many prominent academics to essentially take matters of fact and matters of scientific judgment out of the context and to become hysterical. So I think Roland, a very promising scholar, very important agenda, and to be honest, yes, because he is black, because mm-hmm. and also because he's bright, he's articulate, as mm-hmm. you just heard, I think he has a unique promise in being able to address central questions in the American agenda.
You've got a Nobel Prize sitting on your shelf. You've been looking at these issues for years. You've written extensively about race. Is there acreage that you've spotted, questions that you have on your mind that you haven't gone into, or that economics in general hasn't fully cultivated because of racial sensitivity, because of fear of being misunderstood, misconstrued as racist or anything else?
Oh, I think there's no question that if you looked at academic life in the period, say, between the 1970s and the late the mid-90s, before the publication of the Herrnstein and Murray book, the whole issue about test score differences, never mind the genetic contribution of test score differences, was a very sensitive flashpoint for all of American society. I personally think that the Herrnstein and Murray book was a brilliant book. It failed completely in establishing a genetic case. But what it did do is point out that abilities matter. They are predictive. It's not just taking tests. It's seeing the tests predict who's successful in this part of life, who's not succeeding. And so it allowed us to essentially put on the table, I mean us as scholars in the larger community, if only by attacking it. It was a beautiful straw man. By essentially saying, well, this literature now really does show there's some predictive power, and then to try to understand what was lying behind that. And, of course, it led into the issue of race, and it still leads into the issue of race, as Roland was saying. It's a real question about how these abilities are formed, what the roles are of institutions, cultures, families, and the like. So, yes, I think there's no question that in contemporary American academic and for public policy discussion, it's too sensitive an issue. It's too easy to be tarred and feathered. And Roland has an advantage here, and I think I hope he has the wisdom to exploit it,
not to use it well,
get carried away. But I also worry. To be honest, I'll express a public fear.
All right.
That is, Roland's young, and is a little bit naive. I think he must understand that there are a lot of people out there who are very entrenched, white and black, who have very strong views and do not want to listen to what the evidence is.
And no one's invulnerable, ultimately, regardless of race.
No one is invulnerable, it's not that I'm wishing him ill, but I'm warning him.
Roland Freyer, a cautionary note from your mentor in Chicago here.
Yeah, it's a cautionary note, but it is a comment about American society, though. I think that it's difficult to talk about these issues openly. And in fact, that's caused me in some ways to fall away from writing on the topic, knowing that it's very easy. I've been denounced as a racist, a sexist more recently myself, not in such public forums, but nonetheless, because simple analytical work of the kind that is essential to really understanding these questions is easily undermined by the politics and the frenzy.
An amazing concession in 2005 from Nobel Prize winner James Heckman. We've got to let you go, I know, but thank you so much for being
good
with
luck.
Us. Yep. Nobel Prize winner James Heckman at the University of Chicago. We're talking tonight with Roland Freyer. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unresolved black achievement gap in America and why it's still there. We're talking with a young black scholar who's asking some very tough, very blunt questions about why black America isn't doing better. My guest is Roland Freyer. He's assistant professor of economics at Harvard. You can join the conversation tonight. Can coldly calculating economic research deliver the answers we need on race? Is this ambitious young scholar opening a Pandora's box? Is that what it takes to answer tough questions? And what's the quality today of our national conversation on race and its impact? We're at 1-800-423-8255. A lot of callers waiting, but Roland Freyer, first I've got to turn to you. Your old mentor there, James Heckman, Nobel Prize winner. That's quite a towering figure. Words of support and words of caution for you.
That's what Jim has. He always has words of support and words of caution. I remember once Jim saying, if you ever take any money from special interest, I'll hang you myself. So I just want to tell your listeners how special it is to have probably the most brilliant economist in the 20th century on the show tonight. And I'm just eternally grateful to Jim.
So well, we're glad he chimed in and glad he brought his own brand of candor here. We see we feel the mentoring link right there. Let's get to our callers. A lot of them have been patiently waiting. John is calling from East Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you today?
Well, thanks.
I'd like to address this issue of acting white, which
yes.
is very, very interesting and widespread. The whole thing is an issue of power. If you have power, you have self-determination. If you don't have power, you don't have self-determination. So white institutions are the institutions perceived by the black mind as being the power and therefore
sure.
having
mm-hmm.
self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
Black institutions are seen by the black community as not having power, meaning not having self-determination. When a black child is so-called acting white or studying to do better in school, he's seen as trying to acquire power or putting himself in a position to align himself with a power base that has self-determination
mm-hmm.
where the black experience, the black community doesn't have self-determination.
And so, is that seen as betrayal or proper ambition?
It's just misplaced. It's just a situation where we have to see ourselves as being powerful on this planet and just circle our wagons around our own power and begin to do things and not place other people's interests as a factor.
But John, let me ask you, if I may, if a young black person, boy or girl, is studying hard and not hiding it, is that in itself acting white?
If someone is studying hard, they're just studying hard to acquire some knowledge, but how that knowledge is going to be used, are they going to take that power from knowledge, because knowledge is power, are they going to take that knowledge and circulate it outside their community, or are they going to use that power to bring power and prosperity in this world, the thing is currency or money, you know, is there going to be...
In kind of a black circle.
You know, mm-hmm. we don't circulate money. Money goes from us laterally out from our community. It doesn't circle around in our community. And folks that so-called act white, you know, hey, look, they say people in this economy, educated people, many, you know, they operate more aligned with the power base because they That's a very unfortunate point, too, that you have.
Yep. John, I think we've got it, and it's a great point and a very revealing observation, and I appreciate your sharing it with us. Roland Fryer, let me put it to you. Here's a kind of resistance, even if it's involved with studying. If it's studying to kind of be part of the white power structure, John's communicating that that's a kind of betrayal, as I hear it.
It's really interesting because I share many of the sentiments that, at least anecdotally, that John is describing. And in fact, if you go back and read the history, you really don't see that many accusations of, quote, acting white, close quote, until the kind of breaking down of housing discrimination laws fair housing laws when blacks started to move from areas in which there was lots of heterogeneity. So there were lots of black doctors, lawyers, postmen, et cetera, living in the same community. Mm-hmm. Right? As the barriers to other neighborhoods came down, you saw blacks start to move out.
The black middle class moving
exactly.
up and out.
Exactly. And that's when you started seeing that things like education where, now they're a signal that you actually may leave. Before that, you just wanted to boost up and make people highly educated because they were going to benefit the community. So that goes somewhat to what John is saying. I think he's got to be right that we have to build a culture that, you know, getting high grades is acting black. I think that's probably the key to breaking these cycles.
Mm. Bob is calling from Columbia, North Carolina. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Fryer, Mr. Ashbrook. I'm a 48-year-old white male. I'm a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fryer is the living example of the message I preach daily to my primarily black male high school students.
And what's your message, Bob?
My message is that if you work hard and study hard, especially because you're a black male, the world will open up to you because there are so few that are willing to take the chance.
And how do your classes, your largely black students, respond to that message?
Well, last week, for example, I was in court with half of my class, bright young men, as Dr. Fryer described earlier, that have unlimited potential but unfortunately aren't using it. And my reason for calling is I'm asking for help.
And what's the help that you're looking for exactly, Bob?
Well, I don't necessarily have the street credence that he talked about earlier. I didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth,
mm-hmm.
but I want to know how to reach these young men, and I'm just not having much success, and I'm wondering if he could give me a little advice.
Half the class in court, it sounds like seriously, you could use some, Roland Fryer.
Yeah, it's. I think you start by, I'm not sure street credence is that important for your particular case. I think these kids just need to know that someone cares about them and that understands that you care about their achievement. I think that will go a long ways. I'm not sure. I mean, street credence is going to do much, you know, much beyond that.
But imagine you're 48 years old and imagine you're white standing in front of a class of young black students who will see the racial line and who will bring into the class all the things you're studying out in the world. You can hear in Bob's voice, he wants this to work for them.
Yeah,
he wants to figure out how to turn the light on to show the way.
Yeah, I know. And I think Bob is doing the exact thing that I would do, which is the same thing I do with the students at Harvard when I talk to black students who say, well, the world may discriminate. And I say, it may. But I can tell you what, if you study hard, if you get good grades, if you do well, the world is your oyster and it will open up to you because so many people are looking for talented, young black professionals that I think Bob is doing the same thing I would do, which is tell them hard work and study hard and things will pay off.
And if that's true, why doesn't it fall on, you know, receptive ears? And not always, but we're hearing from someone who works with this every day and saying he's having trouble even though he's saying it. You know, what's the kind of combination of economic or social factors that makes, I mean, we can imagine them, I don't know, anger or if there's poverty, a kind of disbelief that, you know, hey, I'm not a superstar basketball player and I can't maybe picture the bridge that gets me out of here.
It's a terrific question. I think it's, for me, when I was at the stage that Bob's students are, if Bob would have had the same conversation with me, I would have probably retorted, I don't see anyone doing the types of things you're discussing.
Show me, not
Show
in my
me.
Field
exactly.
of vision.
That's right. So, you know, Bob could look for more, you know, There's lots of young black professionals who are doing well who came out of adverse circumstances. And the more examples you can give kids to say, look, these people did not make it through the venues that you're used to seeing through sports or through entertainment. Those are fine venues. I don't want to be misunderstood here. But there is a third road. There's sports, there's entertainment, and there's a third road. That third road is hard work, dedication, doing well in school, and the world will pay you for it.
Well, let's hope that's a message that eventually works. Joe's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Well, thanks, Joe.
I got a lot of black friends, mostly black professionals, and it seems as if they'll go to a particular point in their career and stop.
Kind of plateau, and, you mean?
Well, no, because everybody plateaus at one point or another, but they seem to be frightened of continuing.
Oh, you mean they stop deliberately themselves?
Well, yeah, it seems like they give up, and it's almost as if they're just tired. And, you know, I spoke to one of them, and you know, we were talking about career, his career, my career. And, he said, look, you know, you don't understand. When you go for a job interview, when you went for your first job interview, you were going to sit in front of a white person, and that white person was going to understand you, and he was going to understand how you talk. When I grew up, my grandmother had to tell me that, look, when you go for your first job interview, you're going to be sitting in front of somebody that doesn't talk like you, that doesn't look like you, and you're going to need to talk the way he talks in order to get that job. And he went on and you know, was pretty explicit about how difficult it was for him to escape the world that he was in. And when he did it, he realized he could never go back. And at the same time, never be completely comfortable in the world in which he had chosen to exist.
You're painting quite a picture there, Joe. Roland Fryer, what's your response?
Look, I understand. I don't know of people who have literally stopped because of this, but all of my friends who are black and who are professional talk about the same thing. It's tough to go back home because you've left there and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And you also don't quite fit in with the, you know, hummus and pita bread that you're served in the cocktail hour at your new position. Mm-hmm. So I'm very sympathetic to that. I think the cumulative effects, as the caller is describing, can be tough. What I try to do, and I feel the same thing, frankly, but what I try to do
is. And you're only 27. You've got years, man.
But I feel 30.
Uh-oh. Now, if we chart this on out, you see.
But I think what I try to do, and I know this is difficult, is just focus on the task at hand. I focus on the task at hand. I'm doing my work. I'm trying to focus like a laser beam. And I try not to let those other things bother me. I agree that they're unfortunate. And frankly, until we have successive generations of blacks in mid-level management, et cetera, I think this is going to be a temporary problem. I think it will be overcome in the future. But I think it's something that we have to deal with now. And as we get successive generations, blacks become more prevalent in mid-level managers, et cetera, the likelihood that blacks will be able to sit across from an interview table and feel comfortable.
The headwind won't feel so strong.
That's exactly right. I think that we'll have a headwind for quite some time, but it certainly won't feel as strong.
A piece at a time. Joe, thank you very much for sharing that. Lynn is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just calling because I am an educator and have been for 14 years. And the educational system in America is very much a socialization system. We are not only giving our students information, we are training them to be citizens, and we hope to be training them to be good citizens. But essentially what we're doing is training them to be good citizens of American mainstream culture. And if you belong to one of the sidestream American cultures, you can see this as intense pressure to move outside of your own culture, and that may be good or that may be bad, because some of us are more subject to the pressure to raise in status, and some of us are more subject to the pressure to be like our buddies, to be like the people we grew up with. So it would certainly make sense for black students to reject, you know, American educational system.
So black students resisting the socialization implicit in their education because it's kind of equating good citizen with white citizen or white citizen style, even now?
Even now.
Roland Fryer, does that add up to you?
I think there's certainly cases in which that's true. And that's where I try to look, I don't think I'm a role model for anyone, but where I try to be...
You just might be.
well, hopefully for the kids we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. That were in, but I think what I try to do is just be myself. So when I talk to kids, I basically say, look, you don't have to whitewash your culture to be successful. I mean, I think the Times article, I was very pleased about this part, mm-hmm. where it says he doesn't want to be white and he doesn't act white. Mm-hmm. I'm me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that... was from, you know, I grew up in public school, so I think there certainly are situations in which the caller described, but I don't have data, but I hope the vast majority of our schools are allowing people to be individuals.
But we're hearing from the front lines here, from Lynn in Lexington, Kentucky, that it's ain't necessarily so.
I'm sure it's not necessarily so.
Roland Fryer, I wish you'd share just a little bit with us something of your journey, because as we've heard from many callers tonight, you've got people starting in places where they don't believe they can get to where you are. You're now in this wonderful position doing research at Harvard. It's been a great ride, but it didn't start out easy, and I wish you would share with our listeners just a sense of that. I know the Times went hog wild with that personal story, maybe more than you wanted to share.
Certainly.
But it's important, in a sense, to share something of where you came from so that people have an idea just how far you can go.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'll start with saying I met my mother, I think, when I was 21 years old, and... You know, my father made some mistakes. He's not the, you know, they went after him a little bit in the Times, but he's not a perfect guy. I think he's apologized now. And I was I was on the way to nowhere, frankly.
Your family, extended family, took care of you, but they were living a life that's rough.
Exactly.
I mean, there was crack being boiled in the kitchen and a whole lot of people who ended up in jail, if I've got this right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know what
What was that experience when you were 15? We referred to it earlier briefly, but what was it that sort of put your road to Damascus experience there?
Well, I was doing some bad things myself, and I was pulled over by the police, and I told to get out of the car and put on the pavement face down, and their guns were drawn. And I think it just was at that moment I realized, I don't want to do this. Everybody around me has done this, and I don't want to do this. And I think there just comes a point in kids' lives, whether it's the kids that we talked about earlier who are on the path, not on the right path, that you have to decide what kind of man or what kind of woman am I going to be. I see all these things happening around me, but I don't want to be that. I want to be something else. And that's what it was for me, just deciding, look, this is not the type of person I want to be. And I think, you know, that's a highly individual decision. And for the youth that are out there, you can make it. You can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can start studying hard. You can work hard at school. And look, if you do it, it's likely it's going to pay off. My bet is it's going
to
pay off.
If your research works out, it should get easier to
do
it.
That's
right. How close are we to understanding? Unified theory of Black America is too much to ask, but how close are we? I mean, are we
We're a long ways off.
And will science really help untie this knot?
I don't know, but it's the only way to go. It's our only hope, Tom. It's our only hope. We can't sit on Crossfire or CNN or these other shows and yell at each other across the TV screens. We've really got to sit down and have someone think carefully about these issues. These issues are, we've got an American emergency on our hands here.
Roland Fryer, we're glad that you're at it. We're glad you've got many years to go to do it. And we're very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. Roland Fryer, junior fellow in Harvard Society of Fellows, assistant professor of economics at Harvard University. Watch for his ongoing research. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.